Fuel excise relief to be extended for one more month at a lower rate as the government hopes for a permanent end to the war in the Middle East. But there's confusion this morning over the Strait of Hormuz, with Iran announcing it's been closed once again. Shadow Foreign Minister Ted O'Brien joins us this morning. I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. A temporary tax cut is never easy. This morning, the Prime Minister has confirmed a one-month extension of fuel excise relief. But the 32-cent a litre discount will be halved in July before the full excise is restored in August. The fate of global oil supplies, however, remains uncertain. Iran has just declared the Strait of Hormuz is closed again over Israeli attacks in Lebanon. Donald Trump's already precarious deal is looking even shakier. All this comes ahead of a critical parliamentary fortnight where the government's hoping to pass its contentious budget bills. Tax reforms, however, are small beer compared to the agenda Pauline Hanson laid out at the National Press Club.
A debut 30 years in the making.
She had plenty of targets.
We cannot be a multicultural society. We must be monocultural.
Well, I don't know what a monoculture is.
Sparring with the media.
I don't answer to the media. I answer to the Australian people. You never give up. I've never seen a person that's such a trashy journalist.
A One Nation government would make the ABC subscription only in the cities and shut down SBS.
You're going to be without a job.
She's got no respect for journalism. She's got no respect for the basic pillars of democracy.
Industrial relations, I can assure you, needs a complete overhaul because it's not working. And if women take time off, why should business pay them if they're not at work?
Workers' rights to be renegotiated in favour of bosses.
You can't sack people these days. They actually are lazy.
No, that's not how we feel about workers.
Her speech sensationally disrupted by a stunt.
Every day, organisations like the Salvos...
Left-wing activist group GetUp claiming credit.
Is this another first?
I believe it is.
I get a lot of firsts in my life.
Pauline Hanson and her billionaire backer.
Thank you, Pauline. You give Aussies across our country hope.
I didn't hear anything about cost of living.
The problem with what we heard yesterday is it's not a credible plan.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Senator Pauline Hanson.
It's part carve out and part cave in.
As his current number one political threat continues her charge.
While she's dividing the nation with provocative statements, he's trying to unite it with positive changes.
This is genuine reform. Genuine reform is often difficult.
It's always contested. It's always contentious.
Labor is scaling back key elements of its controversial capital gains tax overhaul.
We will be seeking feedback on that.
It's polishing a turd, to be frank. It's a bad tax program.
Today is a massive back down on a budget that hasn't even lasted through one season.
The government wants this reworked plan passed by Parliament this coming fortnight.
We've still got a way to go, and really, the government could have been so much braver and actually tackled the housing crisis.
Thanks very much.
Well, we are joined this week by political and international editor at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, Peter Harcher, Melissa Clark, the host of the ABC's AM program, and chief political reporter for the Australian newspaper, Greg Brown. Very good morning to all of you. Let's start on the fuel excise news this morning, Peter. They're extending it for a month. The discount, though, is halved to 16 cents a litre before it goes in August. Given how shaky things look with the Strait of Hormuz, is this sort of cautious tapering off a sensible way to go?
I think it's prudent, yes. There is uncertainty about the oil supply, but the price has come back down. The price at the pump now is back to pre-war levels, although if you add the full excise back in, it'd be about $2. But that's still a pretty reasonable price, so There's no case, really, to keep the full excise discount running. But there is a case for tapering it off, because even at the half rate, it's going to be $400 million extra budgetary cost. And that just goes straight onto the deficit. Mm. Or they have to cut some other service that we don't really want cut. The deficit's $31.5 billion and we have to pay interest on that.
And it's a reminder, isn't it, of just how easy it is for that money to go out the door when you have to do things like this. And the PM was asked, Mel, this morning on Sky News by Kieran Gilbert about, well, if things go bad, might you have to extend again for another month? And look, he is keeping options open.
This is about providing certainty. Of course, we do live in a volatile world. So were there to be a massive global shock again, my government will always respond.
So there you go.
Look, I think the government's shown what a difficult environment it is to operate in right now. You make a decision, you try and wait as long as you can to get the best sense of what's going on in the Middle East. You finally make a decision, 24 hours later, the situation's changed again. There's a bit of sympathy there, but I think the tapering down is also really sensible because they are very conscious of consumer behaviour, right? If everyone knows that the half an excise cut is going to come off on a particular date, everyone's going to try and fill up their cars the day before that happens. And we're going to end up with at least a little mini crunch of supply. So I think tapering off helps in some of that consumer behaviour. And given where circumstances were internationally at the time they made that decision, I think it was a reasonable one.
Yeah, and we've seen the propensity for people to run out with their jerry cans if they think the price is going to keep going up. Greg, Peter's right, though. This is more adding to the deficit, isn't it? This is more money going out the door.
Yeah, not only that, it's adding to aggregate demand as well, making the Reserve Bank's job harder. There's no offset announced with this. So, it does mean that, as Saul Eslak says, what the government giveth, the Reserve Bank can taketh away at a time like this. So, listen, I don't love these policies. I thought the initial three-month halving of the excise was a mistake, particularly at a time where it looked like we may be facing petrol and diesel shortages. Now, the government has secured supply much better than expected. But I have to say, tapering it for a month, they've not gone the full 3 months. So I think they've taken the middle ground approach. So they deserve credit for that.
Now, this comes ahead of a parliamentary fortnight that's going to be pivotal for trying to pass those budget measures, capital gains tax, negative gearing. The government is very confident, I understand it, they'll get the Greens' support. They've offered them now a delay on the vote on the NDIS changes until August because the Greens are strongly opposed to those NDIS changes, so it allows a longer period of time for those to be looked at. But it will get through, it's very confident, the negative gearing capital gains tax changes. Peter, the changes the Prime Minister and Treasurer announced the other day on the capital gains tax front, they pitched that as, well, this is just part of the normal process of consultation. We've listened over the last 5 weeks and here are some changes to give, you know, more generous exemptions to small business and fewer discretionary powers to the Treasurer and so on. Is that what it was, or was this a humiliating back down?
Well, the opposition's calling it a humiliating back down and the government's calling it a sensible relief. Mm. But the political motivation here was removing or surrendering ministerial powers was a demand of the Greens to get it through. And it's certainly not a big issue, so they had no trouble agreeing to that. The decision on testamentary trusts, I mean, that's certainly you can call it a backflip, reversal, whatever you want, but they were getting a lot of political pain because that was allowing opponents to run a misinformation campaign saying it was a death tax. Mm. And they're only getting 10,000. There are only 10,000 of these trusts out there. The revenue cost is trivial, so they had to get rid of that. That was a clear bit of what John Howard would have called barnacle removing.
He's cleaning it up. Yep.
Exactly. And the small business, by extending it, the complete exemption to another, it's about an extra 160,000, 170,000 small businesses. Again, the whole cost of this is only $500 million out of an $8 billion expected revenue gain. So the cost is small. There's an election 2 years away, so nobody will even remember or care. We just don't. The collective political show moves on. This will be ultimately a pain-free backflip for the government.
You might be right in time, but right now the critics are still outraged about what they're doing. They want the whole thing scrapped. I spoke on the podcast this week to Andrew McKellar from the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and look, he's certainly still not happy with where they've landed.
This is starting to look a little bit like, you know, one of those American celebrities who's had a bit too much plastic surgery, and it ends up, you know, they might think it looks beautiful, but to everybody else, it's just a freak show.
It's quite a line.
It's quite a line he's worked on, but I think there's an element here of this back down, and parts of it were what they said they would do, and parts of it clearly are a political expediency matter. They'll get it through Parliament with the Greens. The only question is, can the Greens get a little bit more of a concession for doing it? But I think what they're really doing is compounding an initial problem with this policy, which is that it's a little bit in limbo land. It goes far enough that it annoys some vocal critics that no matter what concession they make through this process, they're never going to be satisfied. So they will continue to be loud. But there's still this question of those that it helps don't feel that it goes far enough to make a significant and material difference. So they're not going to speak out loudly in the public realm pushing for it. So Labor's left without a friend or a natural ally to help advocate for this policy. It's still in that limbo land, and this tinkering really exacerbates that problem.
Well, Greg, what do you think? Will the caravan move on, as Peter suggests, or do you think there will be lasting damage for Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers over the broken promise and the impact of what they're doing?
I suspect there will be lasting damage. I mean, the Prime Minister, the whole idea of him being a man of his word was a key pitch to becoming Prime Minister. This was a pretty brazen broken promise, and it wasn't one that they really made the case for. They didn't. It wasn't like in the mid-'80s when Hawke and Keating had a few options that they, you know, debated with business and unions, and famously option C was the government's approach, and then they got under so much pressure they went a different way instead. This has been, they said they wouldn't do it. First budget, they do it. They have a two-day snap inquiry, and then they're trying to ram it through straight away. I do think that impacts the government's credibility. And the other problem is that I think too often they've tried to be too clever by half with some of the politics of it. So in doing the nasty stuff now and then, you know, leaving open the option of further tax cuts heading into the next election, I think there is a risk that the community mindset of this government being all about raising taxes can really set in, and that's damaging.
There's 2 years, though. I mean, I think that's I think it's too early to know whether or not this is ultimately going to be damaging, because as we've seen in the last 2 years, how quickly things can change, how other circumstances come into force. I think we just don't know until we get to a ballot 2 years down the
track. Well, remember when they failed with the referendum on The Voice? Everyone was dancing
the end of the world.
His grave.
Yep.
He wins a huge election victory shortly there afterwards. I don't think there's any... Likewise with the broken promise about the Stage 3 tax cuts. Mm-hmm. They did it, they were very worried about it, but because people saw it as a benefit, they got away with it. If this ultimately is seen as a benefit, if it does in fact, and the early indications are that it is, helping to redistribute buying opportunities from investors to first home buyers, then I think a lot of the intended constituents who don't yet appreciate that
And aren't out vocally cheering for it, because at the moment they aren't seeing the material difference.
Yes,
that might be different in 18 months.
That's right, if it's seen to succeed. And can I just... let me add two quick thoughts. One is, I don't think in politics there's any lasting damage or any lasting gain. I think it's like the tides. They come and go depending on events. But I'd also point out that the amount of controversy, what we are now seeing as this huge, raging controversy and storm and criticism, is but a passing cloud compared to the rage and fury that accompanied the benefit of being around for as long as I have, 45 years. I was there for the Hawke Keating reforms and the Howard Costello reforms. The whole country was angry, opposed at one point or another. I remember during the Keating stuff, Keating said to me at one point, we used to talk in those times, he said to me at one point that every industry, the unions, his own caucus, everybody in the country was against him. He said, my only ally was the Canberra Press Gallery. This is relatively a very calm morning cloud.
Interesting. We need to move on and turn to the Middle East and hear from the Shadow Foreign Minister, Ted O'Brien, to take us there. The deal to negotiate a deal to end the war.
This was not easy.
I didn't want to see economic catastrophe. If you kept this going, that could have happened.
It was agreed that our focus would be on ending the war, and we carried out that task.
Hello, I'm the boss.
The only way I can get tougher is if I go in there for another 2 or 3 weeks and continue to bomb the hell out of them, right? But what does that get us? The straight of Hormuz will not be open.
If the other side refuses to fulfill its obligations, the Islamic Republic of Iran will in turn take the necessary measures.
Your relationship with Netanyahu's...
It's good, but we have to keep him a little bit sane.
Are you going to be able to control Israel from attacking Lebanon?
Yeah, I will be.
Ted O'Brien, welcome to the program.
Thanks, David.
So Iran says the Strait of Hormuz is closed again. Just how tenuous is this agreement, do you think?
Well, I do believe it is tenuous, unfortunately, but I think any peace that's been discussed over recent times has been fragile. I don't think that's going to change. That shouldn't take away, of course, our desire to see a successful negotiation over the now nearly 60 days ahead.
Clearly, there's some frustration in the US over Israel and its continued attacks in Lebanon against Hezbollah, that this is threatening its agreement with Iran. Should Israel, in your view, rein it in?
Well, there's no doubt when you have the likes of Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon at the moment, neither of whom are part of the agreement struck between the United States and Iran, it certainly complicates things. There's no doubt about that. I continue to support the right of Israel to defend itself. And where you have Hezbollah firing at the Israeli soldiers, well, of course, there's going to be ongoing conflict. The problem, however, for all of us is we want to see peace. We want to see the Strait of Hormuz opened. And that is going to be subject to an agreement between the United States and Iran. And, of course, that is going to be a serious issue, what's happening at the moment between Israel and Hezbollah, right through until the end, I believe.
But this is where the difficult calls are required. I mean, the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, has been clear from the outset that Israel should not be mounting attacks in Lebanon. Do you have a position on this?
As far as I'm concerned, Israel has a right to defend itself, David. If you think of it from an Australian point of view, if we actually had missiles raining down on our country, the expectation would be our government acts. The Israelis have set up a buffer zone in southern Lebanon. While all of this is going on, there actually is a negotiation underway in the United States between the government of Lebanon and the Israeli government. That's a healthy thing. Mm. But we're dealing with a terrorist organisation. We're dealing with Hezbollah. Again, this is a proxy of Iran, a despotic regime that kills not only their own people, but other people around the world. And this is what makes it so complicated. And I don't think we can simplify it.
But even if what Israel is doing jeopardises peace between the US and Iran and jeopardises the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, you still think Israel is right to keep its troops in Lebanon?
David, if we have a terrorist organisation still threatening the lives of the Israeli people, then I think Israel has a right to defend itself.
Okay.
Now, ideally, I would like to see peace in Lebanon. I would like to see peace prevail permanently in the Gaza Strip. I would like to see peace when it comes to Iran. There's no question of that. Right now, there's no doubt we're at a very, 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 very fragile stage of negotiation. My hope is that both Israel and Hezbollah lay down their weapons so that that negotiation can succeed. Again, whether that happens is going to be subject to their own behaviour. But if Hezbollah continues to fire at Israeli people, well, of course, there's going to be a response, and this is the complication for everybody.
Has the government made the right call here to extend fuel excise for another month but tapering it down?
I do think they have, David. Yeah, credit to them. I think it's a practical step. It's good insurance. I'm glad it hasn't been set for too much longer. I think the real test for them is whether or not they find budget offsets to pay for it. Previously, they didn't do that, which is why we see inflation continuing to rage in Australia. This government just continues to spend. In this situation, I agree with that extension of the fuel excise relief, but it's on the government to find savings in the budget to pay for it. Otherwise, Australians are just going to get stung anyway by interest rates remaining higher for longer.
It's interesting. Angus Taylor was a little more cautious this morning in saying they'd look at it. You'd look at it, but you seem a bit more certain in your response this morning that this is the right thing to do.
I believe it is a practical next step. Again, because they are limiting the time scope, it's a tapering down. However, the key thing from my mind is whether or not they find room in their budget to pay for it. Mm. We are talking about a Labor government which does not know how to manage money. It's very easy to give money out, but a responsible government finds savings to pay for it. For me, that's the main thing for us to be looking at.
Just back to the deal, the MOU between Donald Trump or the US and Iran. Iran has only agreed there'll be no toll on the Strait of Hormuz for 60 days. There's nothing in this agreement at the moment to stop Iran enriching uranium, building more missile stockpiles, continuing to fund proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas. And it will also get $300 billion in a new reconstruction fund. Is this a good deal or a capitulation from the US?
Well, David, it's a deal framework to negotiate a deal. And so ask me the question in 60 days' time. I think the main concern from Australia's point of view should be the risk of an ongoing toll run by the Iranians, basically the IRGC, a terrorist organisation, an ongoing toll for the Strait of Hormuz. From Australia's perspective, I think that's the main thing that we should be concerned about because that has a direct impact on the prices we pay here in Australia. A permanent toll would be bad in practice, wrong in principle, and set a dangerous precedent for how otherwise waterways should be managed internationally.
I mean, of course, the Strait was, before the war, open for free transit. Is it clear to you at this point what this war has achieved?
Well, I think history will be the real judge there, and history, I believe, usually judges conflicts not by how they start, but by how they end. And again, this is why I think we should all be wishing both the Americans and the Iranians well through the negotiation that now has to take place. The number one objective, of course, has to be to ensure that this despotic regime does not procure a nuclear weapon. Mm. That, I think, has been the most consistent message from the free world, especially from the United States. That, I believe, will be the main test through the negotiation.
Sure, but right now there are no guarantees around that. Are you saying that right now you're unable to say whether this war has been worthwhile?
I'm saying right now nobody can tell you the result of a negotiation yet to take place, David. Mm. I'm
was it a good idea, though, this war? I mean, the coalition backed this war at the outset. Do you still think it was a good idea?
Well, if you go back to the basic principle as to why the coalition backed the war, same as the government did, it was all about ensuring that this regime does not have a nuclear weapon. It's to support the downgrading of its missile capabilities. And, of course, we are adamantly opposed to the proxies that Iran manages around the world, spreading violence, and they've done that, as you know, on our own shores.
Donald Trump, we saw it in the clip just before our conversation, saying that he couldn't keep dropping bombs because they'd close the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump's also admitted he agreed to this MOU because he didn't want to see an economic catastrophe. In other words, the economic pressure applied by Iran worked. What message does this send, do you think, to China?
I think the message it sends to everybody is that we are entering a new era of diplomacy, a new era of international affairs, where security and economics are converging, they're intertwined. There was no doubt that the United States displayed absolute dominance militarily in Iran, but Iran was able to effectively hold the world's economy hostage through the Strait of Hormuz. It goes to the interaction between economics and security. It's something that the Australian government, I believe, is yet to get its head around. This is in some ways not new in international affairs, but I do believe that we are seeing a far greater convergence between the two.
And does that mean coming to China, if they can find a way to squeeze the economic pressure on the United States, does that mean they will have the leverage to do what they want?
My comments don't really reflect on what I think the People's Republic of China may or may not do in the future, and I wouldn't be running commentary publicly on that anyway, David. What I would say, though, is that convergence between economics and security is something about which the People's Republic of China understand very well. The Chinese Communist Party ultimately steer both government and the economy from the one hand. It is something with which they are very familiar. But the lessons they might take from this, that would be part of a far larger interview. But again, yeah. I'm hesitant really to be running a commentary on what China might be thinking.
I understand. Well, look, let's turn to, you've just come back from the Pacific, a visit to Fiji and Papua New Guinea. Climate change is a big issue in the Pacific, as you know. Did anyone there raise with you the coalition's decision to walk away from the net zero target?
No, it wasn't raised, David. Climate change was raised. It wasn't by any means the main theme raised in either Papua New Guinea or Fiji, where I spent last week. They're more focused really on dealing with issues of poverty, cost of living, infrastructure, power, water, telcos. These are the things front of mind for them. When it came to climate change, it was mentioned in passing. I certainly also spoke about the coalition's views. But I didn't do what Labor does, David. Labor has misused the relationships in the Pacific to play partisan politics. I don't believe in that. We need to demonstrate as much bipartisanship as we can. We need to be Team Australia, especially when it comes to our closest neighbours in the Pacific. I didn't politicise Labor's very poor performance on climate change. Let's not forget, emissions are actually higher now than what they were under the coalition. I didn't talk like that when I'm in the Pacific.
Okay, well,
we shouldn't talk like that. We shouldn't actually have political fights in the Pacific, and that's a key criticism I have of the Albanese government.
Okay, well, leaving Labor to one side, I mean, PNG's foreign minister said when the coalition dropped its net zero ambition that he didn't know what planet you guys were on. So that sentiment wasn't expressed to you?
No, that sentiment wasn't expressed to me at all.
Okay.
If I heard one key message, David, to be honest, it really wasn't about climate change.
Right.
The key message is concern about a maritime drug highway coming through the Pacific Islands. That's actually the number one thing that I kept hearing about. It's a deep concern to the people of Pacific. Sadly, actually, Australia and New Zealand are lucrative markets for cocaine and meth. A lot of the drugs are coming through the Pacific. The lack of security means these people are being hit themselves, local distribution networks. You know, I visited the largest hospital in Suva, and you're talking there to a gynecologist who is saying 1 in 10 women are presenting to her pregnant with HIV because their partners are sharing needles.
Well,
these are the real issues on the ground.
Yeah, around foreign aid, Australia's biggest aid donor to countries like Fiji. Pauline Hanson raised a concern at the National Press Club, though, suggesting we shouldn't give aid to Pacific countries that are also taking aid from China. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I disassociate myself from some of the comments that Senator Hanson made, especially about PNG. On one hand, I think she's identifying a legitimate point in that we don't want to see any nation overly strategically dependent or overly financially indebted to any country. And we don't want to see any nation in our own region in that position. To that extent, I think it's a fair point, but I completely disagree with Senator Sanson's solution. I mean, the idea that you effectively hold a gun to the head of our Pacific neighbours, that's not what a friend does. That's not a way of building trust. You don't basically create an ultimatum. And you certainly don't say it's all about who you're going to get money from. The relationship that we have with the Pacific Islands is far deeper than development money. And if you were to narrow the debate to just that, well, you've got to be careful who you're wanting to go into a bidding war with. You go into a bidding war with someone with deeper pockets, well, you're going to lose that.
Okay.
And so, look, Senator Hanson has, you know, I think called out a legitimate concern that we shouldn't have anyone overly dependent. But I believe her solution is completely wrong for the Pacific, and it is not in our national interest.
Just on the domestic front, what about Pauline Hanson's comments on ending multiculturalism? Do you think the Liberal Party should be doing any preference deals with a party that wants to end multiculturalism in Australia?
While I didn't actually see the Senator's comments, I did read them. Again, I disagree with her on this, David. Did Senator Hanson make a decent point about a fraying of social cohesion in Australia? Yes, I believe she did. Again, I think her solution is completely wrong. I mean, Australia is made up from people that have come from every corner of the planet.
So should you do any preferences with a party that wants to end that multiculturalism?
Well, if I can sort of just end my point, David, the last thing we should be doing is trying to force Australians to adopt the same customs. What we should be doing is focusing on the importance of Australian values. Mm. It's only values that have the capacity to unite Australians, whether it be freedom, equality, a fair go.
If it's the last thing you should do, would it be a good idea to preference that party?
Well, when it comes to preferences, as you well know, David, that's always up to the organisational wings. But if I have to have a choice between preferencing someone like a One Nation versus preferencing the Greens, give me One Nation. The Greens are a dangerous political movement as far as I'm concerned, and this Labor government...
What about a choice between Labor
to negotiate
and One
with them?
Would you preference One
every
Nation
single
over
time,
Labor?
Every single time Labor goes to an election, they have that deal with the Greens. Hmm. They have never fronted to a camera and justified that, David.
Okay.
But as for the broader arrangement, you know, again, that'll be up to the organisational wing. It always is.
All right.
I'm sure they'll get it right.
And your party president, Tony Abbott's already making some his position on that known. Look, finally, you were deputy leader to Susan Lee, who was dumped by the party because the polls were so bad. Some of the polls now are even worse. Does that frustrate you?
I think everybody is frustrated with where the polls are because we've got a lot of work to do to win back the trust of Australians. But I think that frustration is not a reflection of any individual. It's not a reflection of leadership bids. We're at a very difficult time at the moment in Australia. I think the Australian people are, for good reason, genuinely concerned. Their way of life is just completely deteriorated under this government. I think this government has lost the trust of the Australian people through their lies. The challenge for us, though, as a Liberal Party and as a coalition with the Nationals, is we've got our work to do, our work cut out for us, to build that trust up so the Australian people recognise that, as history has shown, it is only the coalition that can get this country back on the straight and narrow, improve the books, restore the standard of living of everyday Australians and protect their way of life. That's certainly not going to be any other party. It's going to be the coalition only, David.
All right. Ted O'Brien, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, David.
Well, coming up, One Nation takes centre stage at the National Press Club. We'll look at how the major parties are responding to that as well. First, let's get back to our panel, and we're joined once more by Peter Harcher from The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, Melissa Clark, the host of the ABC's AM program, and Greg Brown from The Australian. So I want to get into this deal that Donald Trump has done, or the MOU with Iran, Peter, but just picking up on what Ted O'Brien had to say there, there is an interesting point of difference between the government and the opposition here about Israel. And Israel and what it's doing in Lebanon is clearly one of the big sticking points right now in whether this peace is going to last.
Well, if you look at that MOU, which the Americans have to call an MOU, not a deal, because apart from anything else, as soon as you call it a deal, the Congress has to approve it.
Right.
The problem with the deal is that it seeks to bind Israel. The Americans seek to bind Israel by saying, it's in the first point, you only have to read the first sentence, and the sanctity, the territorial sovereignty and sanctity of Lebanon is specified and guaranteed in that document.
But Israel's not a signatory, nor is Hezbollah.
Precisely, precisely. So but that document has made the US responsible for Israel's conduct. But nowhere in that document is there any attempt to restrain Iran from supporting Hezbollah or its other proxies. So this is why the entire political spectrum in Israel has fired up with anger at Trump for this deal, because it seeks to bind Israel and not Israel's enemy.
Is this also why we haven't heard boo from Benjamin Netanyahu publicly since this document became public some days ago?
Well, I don't know what he tells Trump on the phone, but in reality, this is a stinker of a deal, and he cannot own it.
Yeah.
And he will, as long as Hezbollah is firing at Israel, he will fire back. He's got an October election looming. It would be politically terrible for him to be seen to be a lapdog to Trump. And look, the original sin here is that Trump was dragged into this war, was talked into this war by Israel. It started on Israel's terms and timing, and it looks like it's going to be ending on Israel's terms and timing as well.
And there's certainly nothing in this MOU that suggests the US has much leverage to deal with at all as it now goes into this 60-day period. I mean, Ted O'Brien there was saying he wants to wait to see how it ends before we start to write history. But I think this MOU gives us a pretty good first draft. If you look at the details, it makes firm, unequivocal positions from the US that the US will provide funding for Iran to help pay for reconstruction, that the US will end its naval blockade. When it comes to any demand that it makes of Iran, it says things like must consider, that it will look to. There are that many holes in this draft, and I think that tells us everything that we need to know about the leverage of where we are. The US had the threat of military power coming in. It's now used that and has been shown that it does not have the outcome that it would. It turns out it would have been better just to threaten rather than to actually use it.
So just on that point, leverage, right? We're beginning this, or the two sides are beginning this 60-day period of negotiation. J.D. Vance has hopped on a plane to head to Switzerland. He'll you know, at that very senior level, be leading the US delegation there. So they've got a lot to negotiate. Donald Trump, however, just to go back to what we heard in that clip earlier, has said in this Axios interview, the only way I can get tougher is if I go in there for another 2 or 3 weeks, continue to bomb the hell out of it. But what does that get us? The Strait of Hormuz will not be opened. Now, that's a statement of the obvious, Greg, but it's also a big concession at the start of negotiating with Iran, right, that you guys have got us. You can shut that Strait of Hormuz. That's why I can't keep bombing you.
That's right, and it doesn't set a good precedent for, you know, the West and the US response for economic coercion. And this has been a big, you know, this is now the ace up Iran's sleeve, that they can just put a halt to a significant portion of global trade in one fell swoop. What I thought was interesting about that Ted O'Brien interview as well is that he was reluctant to say to reiterate the coalition's previous position of supporting the war, and he was very quick to link Labor's initial support for the war as well. So you get
both sides backed it, right, from the outside.
Yeah, and he's very keen to state that.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously in the past the coalition had been sort of trying to, you know,
differentiate.
Exactly. So I think the sense is that the coalition as well are seeing that this war may well have further to go than what this MOU suggests, and it's becoming increasingly unpopular.
Peter, it's pretty hard to answer that question, has the war been worthwhile? Because it's pretty hard to say that right now, isn't it?
Well, you put to him the word, is this a capitulation? Of course it's a capitulation. That's exactly what it is. The So he's said that his primary goal, 99% of the aim, he said, is to make sure Iran has no nukes. Well, first of all, the two points here. Both government and opposition use this as their excuse for supporting this US and Israeli-led war. It's a false premise. Both the IAEA in early March said there was no Iranian movement towards any nuclear capability beyond what they've already got and was buried largely in rubble. And the US's own head of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard at the time, said the same thing in written testimony to the Congress. There is no imminent nuclear threat to the US from Iran. So the whole thing was a false premise. Labor and the coalition latched onto it as a way of supporting the ally, but it was never a real threat. And what's in this MOU now about the nuclear program? The only stipulation that Iran has agreed to is that it will agree to dilute the highly enriched uranium, 440 kilos of 60% enriched uranium, which it already has buried underground. That's the only thing they've agreed to do. Now, well, they've also said we don't want a bomb.
Yeah, but just on that, Peter, the Iranians have said for more than 40 years we're not going to develop a bomb.
That's
they've
right.
still obviously right. been enriching uranium to a very high level, to that 60%.
That's right.
Given what's happened, their supreme leader is killed in the opening stage of this war, and now his son and a whole bunch of new faces are there. Will their ambition to have a nuclear weapon really disappear?
No, of course not. And if they agree, as they appear to have for the purposes of this MOU, to dilute that concentration of 60% down to something less, well, it's meaningless because you can easily intensify it. You can concentrate it again later.
And this time around, unlike the JCPOA, there's no framework, or there's certainly not, and we'll see what happens in the next 60 days, but I doubt we're going to get to a framework where there's an agreement around inspections processes, ongoing
right.
consultation,
well,
all of that
said,
apparatus
what they
will
have
now
agreed,
be missing.
What they have agreed to is that the dilution process will be overseen by the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency. But that's it. That's it. So once diluted, what do you do then? It's up to them. They will continue to want to develop the nuclear bomb as a deterrent to its neighbours as well as to the US and Israel.
Let me draw a little segue here. Donald Trump's deal or MOU being heavily criticised. Nigel Farage's Reform Party facing some questions in the UK after underperforming in the Makerfield by-election where Andy Burnham has stormed in and has now got his eyes on Downing Street. Pauline Hanson here, Greg, fronts the National Press Club for the first time. What did she want to achieve and did she achieve it?
I think she wanted to achieve legitimacy in the eyes of the political class. I think that there was that the Press Club had been courting her for a period. I do feel that they were worried that if they kept saying no, they'd look like Peter Dutton did before the last election, that she was running away from questions. I think ultimately she wanted to get her message out in a speech, which I think she did. But if she could show that she could take questions from the press gallery that appear to be hostile towards her, then she's strong enough to, you know, threaten for government, which, you know, we never would have thought even months ago. So I think overall, listen, there's huge holes in what One Nation are offering, gaping holes, and they weren't cleared up by that speech in the Q&A. I think she's at a pretty magical period for her because she's 2 years out from an election, so she really isn't obliged to put out that much detail. And she's sort of at such a high watermark that she's riding high with confidence that it's very difficult for the Coalition and even the Labor Party to successfully criticise her. So I think that overall she did achieve her political objective, but there is a long way to go for her, nearly 2 years for the election. And I do think it could easily unravel, but the Coalition needs to keep at it. You know, Tedo...
We'll come to how the two sides are approaching what Pauline Hanson laid out in this lengthy manifesto, Mel. What did we learn, though? Because everybody's known about positions on migration and climate change, but there was a lot more than that.
There was a lot more than that. I mean, just very briefly, I think there's also some interim steps for Pauline Hanson. I think the Victorian election is one that we should keep in mind for their strategy here. I think she wanted momentum and to keep momentum going as we get towards that Victorian poll, where they are polling very well and there is a very real opportunity for them to turn that into something very substantial. But, yeah, when it comes to what we learned, I mean, the question is as much about what people will hear from it, because let's face it, most people aren't us who are going to sit down and listen to the entire address. For a lot of people, they will just hear the frustrations that she is delivering, and that will resonate very well. I think some of the policies that she's talking about around lazy workers and needing to be easier to fire people have garnered a fair bit of attention. I'm not sure that is as damaging as some people are suggesting. I don't think most workers, even if they are a lazy worker, think they're the lazy worker. I think everyone thinks they can identify someone else who's a lazy worker, but no one identifies themselves as the lazy worker who's about to be fired. But I think when it comes to...
The fact that we work in the same office, Mel.
Nothing to do with it. Completely unrelated.
And it goes into that pitch as well, doesn't it? Just quickly, they go into that pitch that for people who feel they're working hard, doing everything right, but they're not getting ahead, it does sort of resonate.
Yes, I think it does. But I think some of the other things she said around paid parental leave, around childcare, these are the sorts of things that a lot of people will see as helpful and answers to those difficulties of I'm working hard but I'm struggling. And if she's saying they're part of the problem, I think that's when you start to see a lot more friction.
Yeah, I don't know. Look, Peter, there clearly is this view, pretty widely held view, that the specifics don't really matter. There's this, you know, surge of support for One Nation because people are just fed up with the system, want to break the status quo. But does that underestimate Australian voters a little? At some point over the next couple of years, will they want to have a good look at what alternatives Pauline Hanson's putting forward?
Undoubtedly, this is a moment of some sort of frenzy. It's a bit of a social fad. It's a fashionable thing for a lot of people to say and to join in without understanding.
Is that all it is, though, do you think?
I think it's much more. Because remember, Pauline was, for many years in the Australian Electoral Survey, the least liked politician in the country. Now she is the most liked. And that's not Hanson. As she keeps saying, I haven't changed. The country has changed. So, at core, she represents a countercultural rejectionism of just about everything. This is bigger than politics. This is rejecting not just the establishment, which is essential to all far-right populist parties. You have to reject the establishment and the elites, but you also have to go after minorities. But she's going much further. She's rejecting settled middle-class values and bipartisan politics. She's pro-gun. She's anti-abortion. She's anti-childcare, and now she's anti-worker, apparently. So, look...
It's quite a list.
So the two things are, for far-right populist parties, it's a two-part formula here. One, anti-elite, anti-establishment. She did that at the press club. What more delicious spectacle is there for her supporters than seeing her in the establishment press institution
taking
itself...
Taking on the establishment.
..being rude to reporters and sometimes even swearing and insulting them in their own castle. So this is, red meat for her supporters.
Yeah.
And then she went through all... I went through 12 different points of disgruntlement. It was a laundry list. It wasn't a manifesto. It's a hate sheet. So she ran through the minorities and all that stuff. But then in response to questions, that's when I think she exceeded her brief, and that's when she went on the rant against workers, against women's rights to childcare and abortion. And I think ultimately, at the moment that won't affect her, but ultimately, to answer your question, David, people will want to look at exactly what she proposes, and when they have a hard look, and when the ACTU cranks up a campaign about her anti-worker comments,
It becomes more difficult.
There's a bit of a chicken and egg question here, though, right? Because that's suggesting that this is a rejection of the major parties that is then seeing support go towards One Nation. I think you could probably also argue that if you're frustrated with the federal government where it is now, the vacuum that the coalition has left because of their own internal space has left more room for her to grow. If there was a more functional coalition as an opposition, we might still see some rise in Pauline Hanson's support, but I doubt it would be as significant as it is if there wasn't so much of a political vacuum left by the coalition.
On the coalition and Labor, for that matter, Greg, how they are responding to what Pauline Hanson laid out at the National Press Club. What have you made of it? Have they found some vulnerabilities to go after, or are they still pretty hapless?
I think Labor's line and length is pretty clear. They're going to stick on the economics. And to be honest, like, Pauline Hanson is very much a cultural populist. She does have populist economic policies to an extent, but she her overall philosophy on the economy is actually quite grounded in sort of neoliberalism and Thatcherism. She's, you know, anti-union. She wants deregulation of IR. She's proposed a flat rate of income tax before. She doesn't like welfare. So I think on that ground, Labor feels very safe and they're very confident that they can take her. They're very confident that they can mow her down.
What about the coalition?
In many ways, grateful they've got 2 years to do it. The coalition are, I think, all at sea on it. That you saw with Ted O'Brien there, he did a reasonable job at it in saying, well, she's raising some reasonable issues, but her solution is not right. Now, that's all well and good, not a bad approach, but I think overall they need to be prepared more often to take her on, to criticise her. Sure, right now, where we're sitting in June 2026, it will go down like a lead balloon among some of her supporters. But they've got to build the case so that if they're building
so
the
step
case...
step it up, take it more aggressive.
Step it up, at that she doesn't have a credible plan. And I think over time, as voters start seeing the hole in her plan, it may resonate more. They've definitely got to keep at that.
Just very quickly, I think it's really interesting to note the very different ways Anthony Albanese, Angus Taylor and Matt Canavan are approaching Pauline Hanson. Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers, to some extent, are trying to say, we recognised you're aggrieved, you want change, we're the ones delivering change. Look, we're doing this tax reform, yes, it's hard, it's messy, but we're the ones actually doing change. It's a pretty hard argument to do from an incumbency, but they're trying to say, we recognise that you want change, we're going to deliver it. Angus Taylor, I thought he was trying out some new lines this week, saying, Anthony Albanese, Pauline Hanson, they've been in politics for 30 years. I've only been in politics for 10 years. He was trying to point out that he's the newcomer, he's the fresh face. Again, I think that's hard to argue from an established political entity. And Matt Canavan's approach is to say, you think Pauline Hanson's a fighter? I fight harder and wants to list everything that he's fought for. So I think you're seeing three different leaders from the main people who are worried about the threat of Pauline Hanson, and they're all trying different ways, which I think tells you they don't know what script works.
That's a really sharp observation. I think we'll see which one succeeds. Let's get some final observations. Greg.
Well, there's been a lot of focus on the breaking the promise on policy from Anthony Albanese, but there could also be consequential implications from breaking his promise on approach to be a consensus leader, to work with business and unions, find a middle ground. We've seen unions felt that they were treated poorly during the Jobs and Skills Summit, that Anthony Albanese just rubber-stamped the union agenda. We've seen the same happen with the Economic Reform Roundtable. Anthony Albanese has used that to now justify reviving the 2019 agenda. So, given business ran dead in the campaigns in 2022 and 2025, are they frustrated enough to actually campaign against the Labor Party on a bigger level? And I think if they are, this does present opportunities for the Liberal Party if they can get their act together.
Interesting, interesting. Mel?
If you spend a bit of time on social media, you might have seen a clip of Tim Wilson and Amanda Rishworth on the Today Show that happened during the week. Tim Wilson got very animated to the point of shouting at Amanda Rishworth, waving his finger around as he was talking about Labor's broken promises on the tax reform. It was something of an unedifying thing to watch. He copped some criticism for it. He explained it as to him being very passionate about Labor's approach on tax reform and defended his behaviour that way. Look, either he intended to behave that way or he didn't. If we take him at his word that he was just being passionate about it, then his inability to control that emotion and behave in what would be a reasonable way seems to have evaporated 1 minute into a television interview, which doesn't speak well to emotional control. If this was something that he decided to do because he thinks it helps sell a message, then I think that tells us that it was a performance designed to be spread on social media, which he did then continue to spread it on social media. Whether it was a deliberate approach or just the way that it came out in his debate, neither of those outcomes speak well to his temperament in that kind of environment.
All right. Peter.
I want to go to soccer, which is having a moment with the World Cup. And last week, you know, World Cup soccer fever just happened to coincide with Refugee Week. I'd make the point that there, you know, while we have this sort of anti-immigration frenzy running, I just thought I'd make the point that refugees have contributed a great deal to our country. There are four in the Socceroos squad at the moment, four refugees. Another refugee, Frank Lowy, at the other end of the age scale, now in his 90s, of course, at John Howard's invitation, restructured and created the modern Australian soccer success, which is the Socceroos. And he's also a bit of a gift to Australia, not only created Westfield, created the modern soccer movement, but and philanthropic organisations, but he's also made given us another gift. His submission to the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism has a message way beyond anti-Semitism, I think, and way beyond refugees. What he says is, what I did with soccer created an architecture for cultural change that we can apply to create cultural and social change in Australia now. And I just want to read the last sentence from his submission to the Royal Commission, which says, only the government can lead a movement away from racism by using all of its tools, including moral, financial and legislative powers, to show we are a multicultural society that supports all of our citizens wherever they come from. Thank you, Frank.
There you go. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Finally, Pauline Hanson has a new title bestowed upon her in rather theatrical fashion by her biggest backer. We'll leave you with Australia's richest person taking inspiration from the world's richest person. Thanks for watching.
Can you all sound like bulldozers, please? Grrr. Come on, I want some bulldozer noise. Pauline, can I... Oh, beautiful. You might remember Elon Musk was given a big chainsaw to try and cut government tape. We need more. We need an orange bulldozer. Let's hear the noise. Grrr. I don't hear that noise. Let's hear a bit more. Grrr.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.